service.
This episode is brought to you in iHeart 3D Audio. For maximum effect, headphones are recommended.
The 27 Club is a production of iHeart Radio and Double Elvis.
Janis Joplin died at the age of 27, and she lived a life that didn't always turn out the way she thought it would. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 16 would be the age she was when she first discovered a world outside of her segregated white picket fence hometown. A world of gambling clubs, wild bars, and strip joints. Places where kids her age simply didn't go. Another one would be the number of secret surveillance files her name would be found on at the University of Texas. Unknown to her or any of the other students targeted for everything from long hair to sympathizing with communists. One more would be the number of breakout folk music stars she would have a serendipitous encounter with at the inaugural Monterey Folk Festival, where she won an open mic contest. Another four would be the number of months she'd spend in New York City haunting bars and hustling pool in the Lower East Side in order to fund a runaway speed habit. And five would be the number of years she had left to live after she woke up from the misery of a drug detox, only to find that the people she thought she knew had been playing her all along. On this, our fifth episode of Season 3, Secret Surveillance Files, Serendipity, and Janis Joplin Walking a Winding Path to Liberation. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. Austin, Texas, 1962. Powell St. John was walking down Neasis Street when he heard the sound again. It idled a short distance behind him, and the low hum of an engine at rest, punctuated every 10 seconds or so by a gradual rise in tone, the soft purr becoming a growl each time the vehicle crept up to keep pace. Powell kept walking. He tried to not let it be known that he knew the car was there. He turned his head slightly in order to confirm that his imagination wasn't playing tricks on him in the hot Austin sun. And Powell came to an intersection, waited for the light to change while his palms sweat. He waited to hear the doors of a car slowly open behind him, to hear the quick scurry of a few pairs of feet on the asphalt, to feel the calloused hands of nameless men grab him by the arms while another hand clasped tight around his mouth, to struggle helplessly as his body was dragged backwards and stuffed into the back seat, sandwiched in between more nameless men, en route to an unknown fate. But there was no door, no feet, no arms. Powell clenched his fists. When the traffic light finally changed, Powell exhaled deeply and began to make his way across the street. It had become a familiar presence, this unmarked royal blue Oldsmobile that trailed behind him wherever he went. Didn't matter what day it was or what he was doing. He was going to meet a friend, he was going to play a gig, he was going out for a stroll and a long toke on a wicked joint. Within minutes, he would hear it. He got to know the very sound of the engine, the timbre of it. He started hearing it everywhere. At night, he would hear the Oldsmobiles rumble in his head when he was trying to fall asleep. He would jump out of bed, part the curtains, and look out the window, and nothing. The next day, he'd be back on the sidewalk, and the sound of his heels clicking rhythmically against the pavement. And soon the rumble of the car was there, accenting the sound of his own feet. It was like clockwork. And Powell couldn't be too careful. Nobody could. You never knew, living that beatnik Austin lifestyle in conservative Texas, what kind of trouble would come looking for you. For Powell, trouble included a pack of University of Texas jocks that jumped him and beat on him because of the way he looked, the people he hung out with, and the songs he sang. It was soon after that beatdown that Powell started to sense the omnipresent car that seemed to tail him everywhere. And on this particular day, Powell was on his way back to the ghetto. That's what everyone called the apartment complex at 2812 and a half Neasis, where his friend and bandmate Janis Joplin lived. A UT student could get a place real cheap at the ghetto. For just $40 a month, you had yourself a glorified closet. The ghetto was home to others like Janice and Powell, musicians, poets, artists, activists. Friends came and went, parties happened day and night. And they talked about music, talked about art, they talked about the university in Texas and the government. And the rabble-rousing nature of the place put everyone there under the watchful eye of not just the University of Texas, but of the U.S. government. Hence the Oldsmobile loitering behind Powell at a safe distance. It was more than cars, and there were files, files in the offices of high-ranking officials. Janice's name was one of over 60 names in a file in the dean's office at the University of Texas at Austin. It was simply marked Ghetto. The file's contents were more than names, addresses, and college majors. The file was textbook McCarthy-era bunk for the new day, full of paranoia, hearsay, and slander. Which kids were thought to have excessively long hair? Which kids were thought to sympathize with the commies? Which kids were thought to have mental issues? Which kids were thought to be promiscuous? Which kids were thought to be homosexual? Which kids were thought to play the role of ringleader? The ghetto was under heavy surveillance, but no one living there had any idea, except Powell. Powell knew something was up, but he was too paranoid to tell anyone about it. He thought they would all think he was insane. Well, Janice wouldn't think so. He could trust Janice. He just had to find a good moment to get her alone and let her know all about the mysterious automobile and the authoritarian microscope under which they were all living. And if he was right about the inevitable life-changing bust that was surely going to come down on their little utopian ghetto one of these days. Powell and Janice played together in a local group called the Waller Creek Boys. Powell played harmonica, Janice sang and played her auto harp, and a third member, Lonnie Wiggins, played guitar. They went heavy on the old-timey vibe with covers of songs like Louis Armstrong's St. James Infirmary Blues and Kitty Wells's It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels. They played at places like Threadgill's, a beer joint on North Lamar Boulevard that hosted Hootenannies on Wednesday nights. At those gigs, Janice's voice sounded like it was coming directly from a scratchy old 78 on OK Records. Janice enjoyed performing with the Waller Creek Boys, but she was oblivious to everything else that was going on around her. It was 1962, and she had recently returned from her brief stint in California that included formative time spent on Venice Beach, only to wind up back where she didn't want to be, at school in Texas. It was Austin, at least, and this time she was studying as an art major, not some zombie brain key punch bullshit. But regardless of major, higher education still didn't suit Janice all that well. Didn't suit her at all, really. She had a big appetite for singing, for drinking, for the biblical companionship of men and women alike. And she later said about her time at UT, "All I did in Austin was be wild, drink constantly, fucked people, sang, and generally made a name for myself." She kept herself inebriated enough that she didn't care if they called her a slut, or a beatnik, or a freak, or a lesbian, or whatever supposed incendiary label one of the Longhorn jocks felt was the slam dunk put down. But the ugliest man on campus contest, that one she actually cared about, that one hurt, that was the last straw. Someone entered her anonymously in the ugliest man on campus contest at the University of Texas. The ugliest man. There were pictures and flyers scattered throughout campus. Even worse than being entered was when they announced the winner. It was Janice. She joked around and told everyone that she had entered it herself as a goof, that she didn't care. But she didn't enter herself in the contest, and she did care. It destroyed her. For comfort, her mind turned to California, to Venice Beach, to a place where no one knew her name, a place that was far out, a place that welcomed her for her. Fuck college, fuck the ugliest man contest, and fuck Texas. She was going back to California, and this time, she wouldn't be back so soon. Powell never got a chance to confide in her. He wanted to warn her about people who weren't who they said they were, warn her about the grass that only seemed to be greener on the other side. Before Powell had that chance, Janice skipped final exams and dropped out. The Waller Creek Boys played a farewell show at Threadgill's on Janice's 20th birthday. And then she and her friend, Chet Helms, stood on the side of the road in Austin and thumbed at any car that passed by. Chet was a civil rights advocate who loved peyote and Ornette Coleman. Like Janice, he was also a fellow UT dropout with a desire to head west. Eventually, a car pulled over, and Janice and Chet hopped in the back seat. First, they dropped out of school. Now, they'd drop out of Texas. Janis Joplin stopped dead in her tracks in the middle of the Monterey Folk Festival fairgrounds. Her head was swimming, and that would be the red wine. Her pulse was racing, and that would be the purple hearts. She couldn't believe what she was seeing. Suddenly, her head went from doing a backstroke to a frantic dog paddle. She could feel her pulse in every extremity. It was Bob Dylan, in the flesh. He was walking towards her, just beelining across the grass of the idyllic seaside city. She was an unknown talent show winner, and he was the Bob Dylan. And there he was, approaching her quickly with a New Yorker's determined stride, probably a New Yorker's determined skepticism, too. It was a Sunday in May, 1963, and the inaugural year of the Monterey Folk Festival was winding down. And the weekend featured performances by Doc Watson, The Weavers, Peter Paul and Mary, Joan Baez, and Bob Dylan. Only one LP to his name and already a legend. His second record, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, was just days away from release. Janis was one of the winners of the open mic contest on Saturday morning at the festival, which gave her tickets to watch the rest of the festival, including Dylan's performance on Saturday evening. It was the first time she'd ever seen him perform live. And the red wine, purple hearts combo had proven to be a hindrance to her performances as of late. She forgot lyrics, missed notes, sometimes missed entire gigs, but not this weekend. This weekend, she had nailed it. She played some of her signature blues songs, Trouble in Mind, Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out. And she sang them with her well-worn gravelly voice, wise beyond its years. She sang them as if she had lived every single word. She impressed the judges enough to taste victory that weekend. Now she was tasting the purple pill she had put on her tongue that day, and the cheap red wine she washed them down with. Dexamil was all the rage, an amphetamine-barbiturate combo that was a favorite of mods overseas and urban bohemians stateside. Kids ate them like they were penny candy. Fucking Winston Churchill popped purple hearts, for Christ's sakes, and they'd be banned within a year. Janis ran her tongue around in her mouth, trying to cast out the lingering taste. She worried that her tongue was swollen, a side effect from the pill or the wine, or maybe the combination of the two of them. At least she thought it was swollen. She couldn't risk a swollen tongue when she was about to talk to one of her idols, because she was talking to Bob Dylan. That was for damn sure. Watching Dylan play a short set the night before, she imagined that it was her standing next to him on stage, not Joan Baez. Not that Janis wanted to be Joan Baez. Clearly the two sounded nothing alike and came from completely different schools of thought. One was Diamonds and Rust, and the other was Balls and Chains. Joan and Dylan sang together on With God on Our Side that night, and Janis closed her eyes tight, clenched the hand of her friend Jay Whitaker in her own hand, and imagined what it would sound like if she, Janis, was harmonizing. Her voice was rough, hard as nails. She was Bessie Smith to Dylan's Woody Guthrie. Joan was too flowery, too timid, too safe. She belonged in a coffee house somewhere. Joan was cappuccino music, not big-time Monterey festival music. In her mind, Janis pushed Joan right out of the way and took her place next to Dylan. It was her turn, her time. Now, as Dylan got within earshot of Janis and her friend, Jay, on the festival grounds, Janis wasted no time. She clenched Jay's hand tighter and pulled her along so that they wound up directly in Dylan's path. "Hey, man," she shouted. "I'm Janis Joplin. I sang here yesterday, and I'm gonna be famous too, man, just like you." Dylan stopped and looked at Janis in the eyes. His stare was deep, but calm. He smiled and he laughed. "Yeah," Dylan said, pausing for a moment to suck on the end of his sour-smelling cigarette. "We're all gonna be famous." Dylan kept walking. Janis was starstruck. Jay couldn't believe that Dylan wasn't an 80-year-old man, which is what he sounded like on that one record. Jay and Janis listened to Dylan's LP at Jay's house when Janis wasn't spinning Bessie Smith records. Jay and Janis were inseparable for the most part. Janis met Jay one night at the Anxious Asp. She was leaning against the bar, short stature, short hair, African-American, androgynous, sweet, funny. Janis had a hard time not crushing on her. And they played pool, sang along to some Bobby Blue Bland that was coming from the jukebox in the corner. She found out that Jay was 4 years her senior, and that she had recently split with the girlfriend she moved to San Francisco with. Within a few months, Janis had moved in with Jay. From an early age, Janis liked boys and girls. She was bisexual at a time when it wasn't just taboo. It was illegal. But Janis didn't fear much, especially that which prevented her from doing what she wanted. She would like who she liked, love who she loved, and crush on men and women equally. but she knew that not everyone was ready to witness such open expressions of love as she was. In the spring of 1962, Janice tested the social waters of a same-sex relationship when she kissed her friend Patty McQueen at a basement party at Patty's house. And they had a captive audience, which eventually included Patty's husband, Dave, who walked in on the two mid-kiss after working the late shift. Like many red-blooded conservative Texas males in the early 60s, Dave thought he had witnessed an abomination. He proceeded to drink heavily, and then, once he was shit-faced, he threw a bottle at Patty, who was passed out. And the bottle missed Patty and hit another party guest, Jack Smith, square in the mouth, knocked his front teeth right out. There was blood everywhere. Patty screamed, both in shock at Jack's busted face and also at her husband's bubbling rage. Jack frantically searched the floor in vain for his teeth, and Janice ended the evening by driving Jack to a hospital. It was incidents like those that prevented Janice from living all aspects of her life out in the open. So Janice kept her relationship with Jay on the down low when she needed to. She had learned through experience how to slip things under the radar, how to achieve the freedom to be who you wanted to be, without letting the rest of the town know about it. And although San Francisco was the most tolerant city she had lived in to date, and San Francisco for sure wasn't Texas, but old habits die hard. But Jay wondered if it was more than that, more than just Janice being careful. Janice told Jay that she loved her. Janice gave her a piece of her heart, but it was just a piece. It wasn't the whole thing. And Jay wondered if Janice was incapable of true commitment, or if she was incapable of committing to a same-sex relationship. She talked the talk, but she didn't always walk the walk. Jay had been around plenty of part-time lesbians in her day, and the more she was around Janice, the more she pegged her as a same-sex tourist. And then, there was Janice's erratic behavior. She would disappear for a day or two at a time. She'd run off with friends or with people she had just met. She'd hitchhike. She wouldn't give a reason for leaving. No heads up. No, I'll be back. And then she was just scoring dope on her own all of a sudden, scoring dope with new friends that she was making. And Jay didn't know if they were exclusive, like Janice had said. She started to wonder if Janice was being honest with her, if they were a long-term thing. And then one day, Janice left. Left. She left Jay, and then she put down some money for a cheap used car and left for New York City. She wouldn't be back for 4 months.
We'll be right back after this word.
June 1964, New York City. The pool table had seen better days. The green felt was scuffed and stained. It was like looking at spots on a green Dalmatian. And there were the old beer spots spilled from a pint in someone's careless hand while getting too close to the action. And there were the blood spots from when Johnny Pocket Paladino had the nosebleed mid-shot that one time. His nose bled because some guy he hustled cracked him over the back of the head with his pool cue, but still, a nosebleed's a nosebleed. And then there were the burn marks from the cigarettes that had been stubbed out by hustlers who were poised to take their shot, but had also happened to reach the end of their smoke. It was easier to stay in position and squish it out on the table than to stand up and ruin the sweet setup. Janice Joplin had never really seen a pristine pool table in her 21 years. It made no difference to her if the thing was spotless or not. All she cared about is whether the table was flat or not. And at this moment, in this particular New York City bar on the Lower East Side, Janice needed to bank the shot. She had 10 bucks riding on it, and that 10 bucks meant another score. She needed to get high, needed to land some more speed. She'd swallow it, snort it, shoot it, didn't matter how it came, she just had to have it. She leaned over the table, closed one eye, and pulled back on the cue. A fat man nursing a Pabst whistled at her, mid-pose. Janice thought for a minute about breaking her concentration, standing up straight, walking over to the fat man with the long cue in both hands, and smashing it straight against this asshole's smug face. It would make her feel 1,000,000% better in the moment. She'd miss out on what she really wanted. She had to stay focused. So she ignored him, ignored the other stares that she knew were coming her way from men and women alike, some stares like daggers and others like lust. She let fly on the cue and the ball went exactly where she wanted it to go. She turned around to face her opponent. "Pay up, man," she said out loud for the whole place to hear, laughing that big, generous laugh of hers. Her empty hand was outstretched in front of her opponent, ready to receive cold, hard cash that she would immediately turn into a warm, hard high. "This broad's fucking robbing the joint," someone said from a few tables away. Beer bottles clinked together and a table of middle-aged guys chuckled. The regulars at the bar thought Janice was all right. She was tough, she was funny, she took no shit. She regaled them all with tales of how she'd grown up in joints like this one. Places like the infamous Keyhole Club in Port Arthur, a dive frequented by gamblers and hookers. She told them about the time she busted this kid, John Clay, upside the head with a metal pail when he was pissed that she had dumped him. And about the time at the Big Oak in Austin when some redneck grabbed her breast. She grabbed the nearest beer bottle and smashed it upside his head. A knockdown, drag-out brawl followed. Teeth knocked out, jaws busted, helpless fuckers chased down by fast-moving automobiles. The regulars at the bar reciprocated and told Janice a story about this one time that a guy walked into the bar right off the street. It was middle of the summer. He had a gun in his hand, a mask on his face. The place was packed, wall-to-wall people. He pushed through the crowd, walked right up to the bartender and said that he wanted all the cash in the till. He was robbing the place. And the bartender was in the middle of making three gin and tonics into Tom Collins. He was fucking busy. And he told the stick-up guy that he was gonna have to wait his turn. No shit, Janice asked. No shit, the regular told her. The stick-up guy eventually got tired of waiting for the bartender to pay him attention, so he just turned around and split. Janice wondered if the story was even true. The place was never packed when she was there, hustling a little pool for a meager payday, and besides, this rundown spot on the Lower East Side didn't exactly scream hotspot. But it wasn't like she was a regular at this place. She had only been in New York City for a few weeks, and she wasn't planning on staying forever. It was the spring of 1964, and Janice had only just pulled into town behind the wheel of a yellow Morris Minor convertible with Linda Poole, one of Jay Whitaker's exes of all people, in the passenger seat. Why she came, she wouldn't really say. Linda didn't even really know why they did it. Was it wanderlust? Was it fear of commitment with Jay? Was it to get lost and to never come back? And the block of New York City they found themselves on seemed to be the kind of place you could get lost in forever if you weren't careful. A-heads were everywhere in the Lower East Side. They crept along the shadows of the tenement walls. They hid behind overflung dumpsters. They scurried down alleyways and peered out from stained curtains that hung in windows of walk-ups. And they reminded Janice of the shadow people in Venice. The ones who came out at night. The ones who would do anything for a score. The ones who made the tourists flesh crawl. New York City was still a few years away from being rebranded Fear City. The town that required its own user manual to help visitors avoid a shocking and violent experience. But some neighborhoods were getting close. Drug dealers staked their claim on street corners. Muggings were on the rise. Entire buildings were vacant and slowly decaying. Cars were, too, left on the side of the road and taken over by A-heads looking for shelter, a place to fuck or a place to score. Janice played a set at Gertie's Folk City in the West Village when she first arrived, but for the most part, her months in the Big Apple were a real gone boondoggle. She subsisted on a regular diet of Purple Hearts. She shot speed with the locals, and she searched out the gay bars and tested the waters. Popping speed led to shooting speed, and by the time she drove the little Morris Minor back to San Francisco, it was all about methamphetamine. Meth was everywhere. It was impossible to avoid. It was the favored street drug on Haight-Ashbury and beyond. The people's chemist, Augustus Owsley Stanley III, set up his first home laboratory to produce meth, not LSD, which he became known for. And by the time she got back to San Francisco, Janice was shooting meth on the regular. It gave her a false sense of power and endurance. She didn't sleep. Her face broke out. Her weight dropped dangerously low. Soon she was slinging speed in order to maintain her habit. That's all there was. A crippling habit. And there were no more Monterey Folk Festival dreams, no Jay Whitaker, no crazy road trips across the country, nowhere to run to. She haunted the places where the drug ran rampant, places like the Anxious Asp, where she once associated with Jay, but now she would associate with the time she was backed against the wall by muscled-up debt collectors and hit rock bottom. Janice Joplin could barely lift her head from her bed. Every time she tried to get up, she felt the crushing weight of a 500-pound anvil pressed down. She tried to rise, and it pushed her right back. And she felt like she had been sleeping for weeks. Her dreams were a hellscape of people with long teeth and sunken eyes. Fires burning, pavement opening and swallowing cities whole. Real end time shit. She tossed and turned. Her sheets were soaked. She felt sick and hungry all at once. She willed herself to go back to sleep. She'd rather live in the unconscious nightmare state than to be awake and alive in the real world. The real world was too heavy. But every action has an equal and opposite reaction. The reason that she was back in her childhood bed in Port Arthur instead of San Francisco, where she had spent the last few years, was because of her actions. She got hooked on meth. She allowed it to take over her life. The junk put her on her ass and then on a bus and put her way back to Texas. But she was motivated to get better. She told herself she wouldn't do it again, wouldn't allow herself to be controlled by drugs, whether it was meth or anything else. If that meant swearing off music and all the baggage that came with it for the rest of her life, then so be it. Still, trying to lift her head, Janice's eyes scanned her body, wasted away, and it was reminded of the recent past. She was scared. The bruises were still there on her abdomen and her arms, from the beating she had taken outside the Anxious Asp. Those two bikers who came to collect only to find a penniless, strung-out dope case. They pummeled her until she stopped screaming in pain, and they figured she had had enough at that point. And the bruises had gone through their multicolor phases, yellow and pink and blue, and now they were stuck on that moldy banana look. And then there were the other scars. She ran her fingers over the marks on her arm where she had shot the junk in, and they were reminders of the black hole she had fallen through. But it wasn't all darkness. There was light. Peter was the beacon, the light at the end of the tunnel. She was going to get clean for Peter, for their future. Peter DeBlanc, the dreamboat she had in San Francisco. He dressed well, smelled nice, drove a fancy car. He was an engineer. He wasn't like the other beatniks and bohemians she hung around with. He was respectable, had his shit together. And he was from money, old money. He would come into his inheritance soon. He told Janice that she would become his wife and they would settle down. She could stay home, raise the kids, take care of the house. The thought of it drove Janice to power through the aches and pains, the anvil on her face, the feelings of sickness and despair. It wasn't until Janice emerged from her bed that she realized that she had it all wrong. It must have been the drugs or the sweat-soaked withdrawals. Janice Joplin, a housewife? No way. The very notion was laughable to her. But even worse, once Janice was clean and clear-headed, she learned that everything she thought to be true was, in fact, a lie. Peter DeBlanc was a lie. At first, Janice didn't believe it. She didn't believe her friends who were trying to break the news to her. That changed when she picked up the phone one day and dialed Peter's number and another woman answered. Clean and sober and way past the hellscape meth withdrawal nightmares, Janice's world suddenly flipped upside down. Peter wasn't for money. He had no money. He didn't have a master's degree. He didn't own a fancy car. He had no intention of settling down with her. He was a world-class grifter. He had duped her. He was an even bigger junkie than she was. Drugs drove him to delusions and waking psychotic episodes. He told her that he was receiving secret messages from the moon. They came directly to his brain. As his paranoia ramped up, so did his gun collection. The trunk of the car he drove around was loaded with pieces that were loaded. While Janice sweat through her withdrawals and shook the curse of meth off her back, Peter had to camp to Mexico with the airline attendant he was having an affair with. Oh, and then there was the other woman that he got pregnant back in San Francisco, not to mention the wife and child he had in New York City. And that wife and child were the ones he had left in the middle of the night when he snuck out, headed west and started assuming other identities. Janice had to forget all about Peter, forget about the promises of a life of domestic normalcy. Peter was no lifeline. No one was her lifeline. People just deceived you and lied to you and let you down. Music was her lifeline. She put herself back out there. She started singing again. She was clean. And then it happened fast. The 13th floor elevator show at the Methodist Student Center auditorium. Rocky Erickson channeling something feral and fearsome. Janice couldn't say what it was, what that thing was that Rocky was channeling, but she could see it. She could feel it and she wanted to channel it too. And then Travis Rivers showed up, the guy who Chet Helms had sent all the way back to Texas explicitly to hunt down Janice and bring her back. Chet needed her. The band he was managing, Big Brother and the holding company, they needed her. San Francisco needed her. It was where she could be free. And Janice went, in an instant, the snap of a finger. She told herself she could dive back into music and back into San Francisco. and do it without getting sucked back into that bottomless black hole of junk and the scars it left in its wake. She was wrong. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. This episode was brought to you in iHeart 3D Audio. To experience more podcasts like this, search for iHeart 3D Audio in the iHeart Radio app. This episode of the 27 Club is brought to you by Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I also host. Disgraceland is available only on the free Amazon Music app. To hear tons of insane stories about your favorite musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly, Nirvana, Prince, Jerry Lee Lewis, The Grateful Dead, The Rolling Stones, Cardi B, and many, many more, go to amazon.com/Disgraceland. Or if you have an Echo device, just say, "Hey Alexa, play the Disgraceland podcast." The 27 Club is hosted and co-written by me, Jake Brennan. Zeth Lundy is the lead writer and co-producer. Matt Bowden mixes the show. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker and Henry Lunetta. The 27 Club is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. Our previous seasons on Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison are available for you to binge right now wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please be sure to find and follow the 27 Club on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your shows. And if you'd like to win a free 27 Club poster designed by the man himself, Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for 27 Club on Apple Podcasts or hashtag subscribe to 27 Club on social media, and we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. Give that a follow. So get out there and spread the word about the 27 Club. You can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter at DisgracelandPod. Rock-a-roll-a.